Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guest tonight is Steve McDonald. Steve, the USS Anchorage calls here in Anchorage the port its namesake, and it was quite an event for the community. It's now over. We can have a total retrospect, please.
It was a love fest, wasn't it? From Wednesday morning at about 8 o'clock when the ship pulled into the port of Anchorage till, it left on Monday, finally. It took off on Monday. It was supposed to go on Sunday, but they changed things around, so they left a day later. But it really was a love fest between the city and the crew of the Anchorage. People couldn't get enough of it. One of the things that happened, people were being turned away from going on the tour. The plan was to have people go to, I think at first it was the Northway Mall and the Sears Mall, and then the Sears Mall became overwhelmed, so they changed it to the Sullivan Arena the next day, where people would gather there and go on shuttle buses. And I think it was pretty well organized by the city and the commission that put together this visit. But the response was so overwhelming. People stood in line for hours and hours, and not everybody was able to get on board the ship.
Am I correct that they shortened the amount of time the ship was going to be here? Sea visitors.
Yes, the that wonderful word that we've just all come to grips with over the last many months.
Don't tell me.
Sequestration. Yeah. It was that was the problem. It was supposed to be up here for almost 2 weeks. That would have allowed, I'm sure, everyone who wanted to go aboard that ship a chance to go on the ship and see the tour. But Congress and Washington, D.C., in its infinite wisdom, couldn't come up with a budget deal, and things like this got.
And when you finally got there, what did a visitor see?
Well, got on the boat. First of all, you walk through the dock area, and there's the ship, and it's a brand new shiny ship. It's just great. Go up the gangplank, get on, and where you first stepped on board the ship, you were on what they call the landing deck. Now, this is a troop transport, a landing dock ship is what the Navy calls it, and the business end is all in the back. There's a landing area that can accommodate several helicopters, a Marine Osprey. If you've ever seen an Osprey, it's an airplane, but the engines can tilt up for takeoff and landing, so
it's pretty remarkable to see.
It really is an amazing machine. It lands and takes off like a helicopter, but then once it's airborne, the engines go forward and it flies like an airplane. So they can land helicopters, Ospreys, on the back end of this. Also, the stern lowers down into the water and exposes what they call the flood deck. I'm not sure if that's the correct term for it now or not, but what they'll do is they'll bring in seawater, and the deck is used as a launching ramp then to take Marines off on their landing craft and hovercraft.
How many men and women do they have on the ship serving?
The crew is about 360 that the Navy has on board, and what they do is they transport Marines anywhere in the world. So the crew is about 360 people. They can take up to 800 Marines on board the ship and their equipment. And this is a modern ship to fight modern day wars. It can take people to a hot spot in the world and deliver these people on a beach or wherever they need to go, the Marines, and do what it is that they have to do in those particular places. And it is a warship, but they will also use it for humanitarian reasons as well.
You can move all kinds of supplies and people who were going to be working in humanitarian activities.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can carry a lot of supplies. And again, you've got that deck, that landing deck, that would allow helicopters in and out, and it can certainly store a good deal of supply down there. And one of the things to show you how much technology has changed our lives, including lives in the Navy, there was already a USS Anchorage. It just wasn't commissioned up here in Alaska. The original USS Anchorage, I believe, was commissioned back in 1967 or 68, if I remember my dates right. It served in the Vietnam War for a bit. It served in Somalia. It served in, I think, Desert Storm in the Middle East as well. But in 2003, it was decommissioned, and then I believe it was around 2006 or 2007, they finally said, let's use it for target practice. But
that's pretty common, isn't it?
It is. So it's at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean right now. But the USS Anchorage today, the present-day USS Anchorage, is about 100 feet longer than its predecessor. And they have about half the crew running the ship, half the size crew on the present-day USS Anchorage as the former. So they have a lot of efficiencies, a lot of technology working on the ship. Stations that used to be manned by a sailor, now they use video monitoring equipment. And so you have a room full of people doing certain things and monitoring the engines via TV monitor at
and
the same
I suppose
time.
There were places you couldn't go on the ship, and the most obvious being the magazines.
Yeah, that's right. There were certain places, that we couldn't go. It's just top secret kind of equipment that we weren't privy to, and they weren't going to let us go there at all. And
or people get hurt tripping over stuff. There are all kinds
true.
Of reasons they don't want
carrying TV equipment down these stairs down into the engine room. We thought, we'll just look at it on the monitors because
And you've also been to sea as a reporter.
Yes, that's where we did most of our reporting. We were down in Oxnard, California in middle of March. We clambered aboard the USS Anchorage there, and we were welcomed aboard by Captain Quinn, who was the commander at the time. And then we had a three-day, what they call a Tiger Cruise, and it's the Navy's version of an open house where they invite mothers, fathers, siblings to come on board and see what's going on. No spouses. They said they didn't want to turn it into the love boat, but they say no spouses are allowed on during the Tiger Cruises, but moms and dads and brothers and sisters and children can come on board. So even media. So we went on and we sailed with
that's
them.
How bad it is.
That's how bad, yeah. That's how they scraped the bottom of the barrel with us. But we went with them out into the Pacific Ocean and went down into San Diego, arrived there 3 days later, and it was a great experience.
Well, and it gives you a real sense of what it means to be at sea.
It does.
And I've only once been on the bridge of a ship, that's a remarkable experience you see what they're doing and what it looks like.
It's one of the most amazing things, and we haven't even done this story yet. We had so many things that we wanted to tell people about, but there was one. They try and combine the training missions as much as possible. Everything they do is training. Even though they had a bunch of civilians on board, they wanted to show people what they do and how they train, and they had training for the crew. The crew's only been on the boat for just a matter of months, obviously. But one of the things they did was they refueled at sea. There was a huge ship, fuel ship, called the Henry J. Kaiser that came out and met the Anchorage out there. And they say it's the most dangerous thing that they do in the Navy, besides, I'm sure, being in a battle.
Well, fuel handling always has the potential in the Air Force anywhere.
Right. And this was made a little more difficult by the fact that we were engulfed in a fog bank and visibility was cut tremendously. In fact, you could hear the Kaiser out in this fog bank with his foghorn. You could hear it, couldn't see it. And then finally, like a ghost ship, we pulled up alongside of it, and you
moving
could see
quite slowly.
Yeah,
I imagine
you could see the you come out of the fog, the stern come out of the fog, and they would shoot the lines over and make this connection, and then bring the fuel nozzles over, and it was a pretty neat operation, and it's almost all hands on deck to make sure that everything goes smoothly and safely. So I got a I've always
the only thing is the fog didn't make for great TV.
It really didn't. I don't know. We could have been 25 feet offshore for all I knew. or 25 miles offshore. But
okay, the unions, the Anchorage municipal unions, go to court over the Sullivan labor ordinances, and we'd speculated here, and correctly, that there would be a court case, and now we're going to have one.
Yep, we knew. I think we joked a little bit last week about this, how Alaskans really get their money's worth out of all three branches of government, right? You've got the executive branch, and you've got the legislative branch, and then we certainly use the judicial branch
frequently to solve the problems between them.
Between the two, yeah. and that's what it's there for. It's it's the arbiter, right? The ultimate arbiter. But the unions, the folks who are fighting this Ordinance 37 that the mayor proposed The mayor says it will make negotiating more efficient. It will also get a handle on municipal costs and on the budget. But the unions say, well, no, this also infringes on our rights to collective bargaining.
As a result of this discussion among these parties and the filing, do we have any better handle on what's legislative and what's administrative?
No,
which seems to be the heart of the argument.
That's
here.
It. And I think that's what's going to have to be decided by the courts. There's administrative parts to all of this that the Sullivan administration says that, well, you know, voters can't decide these kinds of things. And the unions say, well, this is something passed by the assembly, and anything passed by the assembly can be decided on by voters. So the
part of when Dennis Wheeler talked to the Anchorage Daily News editorial board, the municipal attorney, one of the things he talked about was, well, it just would be bad public policy if the voters were deciding some of these so-called administrative matters every year. But in our system of government, the way it works out, the legislative branch could do that every year because we change members, elected officials.
And sure.
If they wanted to reverse this next year, they could if they had the votes and could overcome a veto and all the rest of that. So a lot of this is not self-evident.
Yeah, well, look at, and I'm not astute enough to know all the details and the intricacies, but if you look at Ordinance 37, the labor union ordinance, or whatever you want to call it, that changes the way the city negotiates with its labor unions, and then you look at HB 21, or SB 21,
right.
SB 21, the oil tax overhaul that the legislature recently passed, that's now the target of a voter initiative. I don't know what the differences are.
And that's actually, as it was pointed out correctly on the show by Lisa Diemer, it's going to be a referendum again because it's going to take something that's in law and take it out of the law.
But it would seem like it's a policy issue as well, an administrative policy issue to me. There seems to be some similarities, so I don't know why the assembly overhaul of the labor laws doesn't meet the requirements, but the wording, the two proposed ballot initiatives that have been turned in by the pro-union forces, and this have both been tossed out by the city attorney. So now we're going to court.
Okay, speaking of court, let's talk about the Fairbanks Four and Marvin Roberts, who was one of the men convicted in this notorious Fairbanks murder case of some 15 years ago, I believe it is now.
That's right, 1997. Jonathan Hartman was found severely beaten on a street corner near downtown Fairbanks on a Saturday night. He was barely alive. He died a couple of days later, never regained consciousness. It was a crime that really shook the foundation of Fairbanks. It was a 15-year-old who was out very, very late at night. But he was kind of, the pictures of him showed him in his football uniform, and he looked like this clean-cut All-American boy. And people said, you know, well, if it can happen to him, it can happen to just about anybody. And it was really quite a crime that grabbed a lot of attention. Fairbanks police rounded up four people that they felt were prime suspects. They became known later as the Fairbanks Four, and each two of the members confessed. They recanted their confessions later and said, you know, I was pressured into this. They were all found guilty and sentenced to
pretty
lengthy
terms. And we should
say
there have been all kinds of reviews of the case and the evidence, and people reach differing conclusions. All we know is that they're still in jail.
There's no DNA evidence linking anybody to the crime scene. There were no eyewitnesses. The only person who really put the four of them together through his testimony was a guy named Arlo Olson, who admittedly had been drinking heavily that night, had been smoking marijuana, was hundreds of feet away from where he said he saw the car with these four guys in there. So there were a lot of people, there are still a lot of people up in Fairbanks.
And what's the big new development involving defendant or
Marvin,
convicted Marvin Roberts?
Marvin Roberts, basically, well, he was up for a parole hearing, and last week they granted him parole. But there's a major caveat. They didn't say, okay, you're going to be paroled. We're going to let you free.
Next week.
Yeah.
Here's your suit of clothes.
It's 2 years from now. He gets paroled 2 years from now.
And did were they able to explain to you, Steve, how they do this 2 years in advance?
No, I haven't really heard an explanation. As they can do these things. Obviously, they've got that kind of leeway. The parole officer, Robert's parole officer, had recommended that he be set free. And according to my sources in Fairbanks, they say that, and it's kind of anecdotally, I don't think it's a hard and fast rule, but they say generally, the parole officer's recommendation accounts for about 60% of the decision making here. So it carries quite a bit of weight. A little more than half of the decision is based on what the parole officer says. So the parole board said, okay, yeah, we feel that he should be set free, but we're going to do it in 2 years rather than now. So it's one of the big hang-ups here is that these four gentlemen have always denied their involvement in the murder of Jonathan Hartman. And when they've come up for parole before, when they get to the point where the parole board says, do you have remorse for what you did? They answered, well, no, I'm sorry that Jonathan Hartman's dead, but I didn't do this. So it was like, okay, we're not going to give you parole.
I'm going to tell a little story because I have a personal connection to this trial and to the conviction of these four young men. I know one of them, George Fries, who was connected to my family in some old Fairbanks ways that we won't detail here. I went to his sentencing in Fairbanks after the conviction with his mother, who wanted somebody to come and support her. And it was unlike anything I have ever seen. The defendant denounced the court, announced that he was a political prisoner, spoke to the judge in the most direct and obscene words imaginable, called her a whole variety of names. I just sat there and thought, oh boy, wow. I just had, and then his mother and I left to the courthouse and she called me up later and was talking to me over the telephone and not really talking. It was the sounds of a wounded animal on the telephone of the mother saying, I want my son back, I want my son back. And I had no real idea of what to say. This is a once in a lifetime event. Try to be supportive in some ways, but I mean, there were a whole bunch of troubling things, and one of them being that this particular defendant had a criminal record. Mm-hmm. And if I remember it correctly, it involved a variety of robberies in which he was on his bike going around robbing
tourists. Right.
And I thought, what do you think you are? Jesse James on a bicycle? Stick him up?
Yeah. It was Kevin Peace. And,
was he also
and
in a piece? Was
yeah, in they were involved in some of those incidents when they were juveniles.
And but that came out. I don't know that it came out for the jury. I doubt that, but it certainly came out for the newspaper reporters.
This was a hard case. Everybody lost in this case. Obviously, four young men are in prison, but of course, Jonathan Hartman lost his life. It was a very difficult night. Just about everybody involved.
Oh, and the people were drinking. They'd been to a wedding.
It was a
wedding reception.
Yeah, it was a big social event. Hundreds of people were there at the old Eagles Club downtown, and this is where Arla Olson was. And just about everybody involved at that night, except for Jonathan Hartman, just about everybody involved in the case at one time or another was at that wedding reception.
Or at St. Matthew's Church where the wedding was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's another one.
Downtown Fairbanks.
Yeah. So it was, it's a tragic event. Like I say, a young man lost his life, and there are a number of people who are up in Fairbanks and in the interior villages, too, who have grave doubts over whether they got the right people. There's still a lot of question marks.
Let's take a couple of minutes to talk about the professional love of your life, hockey.
Hockey, yeah.
why doesn't UAA have a coach?
Wow, that talk about controversy, huh? That well, they were,
or I guess yet.
Yes,
is the
one I would have thought that had the process carried on to this point, I think they would have named somebody by now. But There were four finalists that a committee, they went by their rules and regulations, and they formed a search committee, which a couple of coaches there, Rusty Osborne, the men's basketball coach, I think the volleyball coach was involved. I think there was somebody from the academic side, but there were four people who are part of UAA and part of the UAA community. They went through all the candidates, came up with four recommendations, went to Athletic Director Steve Cobb and said, these are the four top candidates. Go ahead and, you know, interview them. So they all interviewed them. They had a public meeting with each one of these folks, and they got a chance to tell members of the hockey community about their philosophy and what they would do with the team and things to that effect. All throughout this process, the Anchorage hockey community was very upset, and then the UAA Hockey Alumni Association also weighed in. Both organizations took votes of no confidence for Dr. Cobb, and then said.
So Chancellor Case had to step into this mess. Essentially, he had to come in and settle it.
Right, and he gave a vote of confidence to Dr. Cobb, who, you know, he's a pretty gruff guy. I've gotten to know him over the years, but he's a pretty effective guy too. It's just unfortunate that the headline program, the spotlight program, or the centerpiece of the athletic program, has done so horribly over the last so many years.
This is what comes of losing somebody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And there's no, there really isn't any sign that it's going to get better. You know, and they had one of their worst seasons ever last year. Attendance has fallen. So alumni, hockey community, votes of no confidence for Dr. Cobb. Chancellor Case comes in, says, no, I give him a vote of confidence. He's our athletic director.
We're going to start the process over and sort this all out.
We're going to keep the four candidates. If they want to be part of the mix and want to be still considered, we'll do that. But he's also, Chancellor Case has brought in members of the hockey community as well to come in and go through
Steve, somebody might say it would take a brave man to walk into this as coach. On the other hand, there are not very many coaching vacancies or coaching opportunities in professional hockey at this level.
No, there aren't.
College and, hockey, let me touch that.
Right, Al Davis, who's one of the notorious owners, you know, the late Al Davis of the Oakland Raiders, he always found a coach, and you knew he did a lot of micromanaging.
He fired them too.
Fired them right away, yeah, too. So somebody always wanted to be a coach there, and I think the UAA job certainly doesn't have that kind of micromanager or anything like that. It does have its drawbacks to some degree, and some very high hurdles that a coach has to overcome to get good players to come up here. But it's a Division I team. And it's in Anchorage, Alaska. That's not bad. Have you ever been up there in North Dakota? They've got an incredible, you know, the Ralph Engelstad Arena. It's great. But, you know, North Dakota, it's like this tabletop, flat as can be, but it's got great hockey history. So I they've got to get a few winning seasons going, and I think they'll get some good players as well to come up here. You know, winning breeds, you know, more winning, I think.
Yeah, this is where if we can just find a few great players and put our name on the map.
But you're right. It is a good job, and it's a great place to learn.
Let's
to be
take
a, head coach.
A minute or a minute and a half to talk about Ernie Hall's public comment ordinance or proposed ordinance.
This stems from
the
labor
union
law.
Dispute.
Yeah. Ernie Hall is the assembly chairman, and he made the decision. There were so many people who were testifying and wanted to testify on this ordinance. He finally just said, look, enough's enough. We're going to cut this off, and we're going to have a vote. Well, that made a lot of people angry. They wanted to be able to weigh in on this democratic process that we have, right? And that angered a lot of people, and also angered our friend Mr. Moe down in West Anchorage, who decided to launch a write-in candidate and nearly beat Ernie Hall.
And the trick here seems to be of giving people their say and who gets to decide how much is enough. Because we've had, not only this event, but other events where busloads of people have been
brought in. Yeah, and after a while, maybe you're hearing the same thing over and over and over again, you know, but it is... your right as a citizen to go to these public meetings and give your opinion. So somewhere you've got to come up with a happy medium. I don't know if you can do that.
So now we're going to have a debate over cutting off debate.
We're going to have a hearing, and you can come testify at this hearing.
About cutting off debate.
About cutting off debate at a hearing. Yeah, so hopefully they don't cut this off here and stuff. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you get out of this. I think, you know, it's the democratic process, and people should be allowed to speak.
I think there was also a lot of concern of who gets to make this decision. Is it if it's the assembly chair, there's some people who don't like that and think it's too unilateral.
Yeah. Well, I've been to meetings like fish and game meetings where they've had a proposal and they've brought people in, people have come in to testify, and you kind of start hearing the same thing over and over and over again. And the person who is moderating the public hearing stands up and says, how many people feel this way about this and want to testify? And people raise their hand, and then how many people feel this way about it? And they just say, okay, we've kind of heard that. Are you okay if we move on and maybe vote on this? And so it's like consulting with the room and the people who are there. And it seemed to come to a peaceful conclusion where the board voted they made the recommendation or whatever it was that they were doing. I don't know if that would work in an assembly.
Well, it may also situation. Be the rules that they work under, and it may be because they're an administrative as opposed to legislative.
As opposed to legislative, that's right.
Well, speaking of cutting off debate, we're going to have to cut off debate, Steve McDonald and I, because we are out of time here on Alaska Edition, but we'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublicmedia.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.